One story that we really, really enjoyed in your book was when you were out sailing and your mom decided that you would all have lamb chops for dinner. So can you tell us what happened?
Yeah, that is
lamb chops will never be the same to me now.
Hi, I'm Kathy Bernard.
I'm Barbara Klein. Thanks so much for tuning in.
First, we'll hear firsthand what it's really like to be a Rockefeller.
Then, inspirational prophets who fall tragically and often comically short of the values they preach.
Plus, the amazing story behind the Caregiver of the Year. Here's a hint. She's 90.
Next, one woman's advice that went viral and not in a good way.
And we'll shoot the breeze with a middle-class Jersey girl turned globe-trotting businesswoman.
When asked by your kids to front the bill for their next expensive gizmo, have you ever responded, "What do I look like, a Rockefeller?" Well, our next guest comes by it honestly. Eileen Rockefeller is the youngest daughter of David and Peggy Rockefeller and great-granddaughter of John D. Rockefeller. At an early age, she learned that her family's name was synonymous with American royalty.
Eileen, whose memoir, Being a Rockefeller, Becoming Myself, joins us from Vermont to share what it's really like growing up a Rockefeller and how she's found her own voice along the way. Welcome, Eileen.
Thank you very much, Barbara and Kathy. It's very nice to be with you.
Well, lovely to have you join us. Eileen, you're one of six kids. What was a typical day like in the Rockefeller house?
Noisy.
Oh, I bet.
In a word, it was pretty noisy with not only six kids, but there were two nannies, and then there was the cook and the kitchen maid and several other maids and a butler and a secretary. And there were probably 50 people who came in and out of the house during any given day.
Really?
Including people coming home for cocktails with my father to, you know, for his business at the Chase Manhattan Bank. And then people would be invited for dinner. Probably they had four dinner parties a week, I think. I don't know. It was very social.
Wow. Where was your home? And can you just sort of describe it for us?
We grew up in the weekdays in New York City at a house in New York City, and then the weekends on our farm. And given the kind of artwork on the walls, you really couldn't just like throw a ball around the house.
It wasn't a typical farmhouse?
Well, the country house was not typical either. It's a Georgian house, but my mother very much understood the value of being outside and with nature and animals, and so we were pretty much outside most of the time on weekends unless it was really rainy. And then we had what we called a dress-up drawer, which was just a trunk of old clothes that came from my grandparents or my mother, hand-me-downs, things that, you know, she didn't really believe in buying costumes. She encouraged us to make up plays with whatever were the old clothes hanging around. So we had a lot of fun stuffing pillows in our stomachs and pretending we were pregnant and things like that.
Sounds familiar. We actually did that too.
Yeah, of course.
I even pretended that I was a nun. I'd put like a towel on my head or something.
Oh, how great. Yeah. Well, I think that kind of thing is really good for kids' imaginations.
It is. I agree.
Well, Eileen, we're wondering what it's like growing up as a Rockefeller. Was a lot automatically expected of you because of that very famous name?
Yes, I think that we were given a fairly heavy mantle. My grandfather's credo that's at Rockefeller Center, engraved in stone still today, among other things, says every opportunity implies an obligation, every right a responsibility, every possession a duty. Well, that's a pretty heavy thing to carry around as a kid. And my mother explained to us that as Rockefellers, we get double praise or double blame. So better to choose the double praise, even though you don't deserve it any more than the double blame.
So did that manage to keep you all in line?
Most of the time. And we did things like get out of the chauffeur-driven car two blocks before school so that we could walk to school and look like we were normal, just like everyone else. And we didn't wear clothes that were different from other people. We tried to, my mother really encouraged us to blend as best as possible.
Well, what were your relationships like with your family and your siblings? Were you all a pretty close family?
Well, I think that my next oldest Ken brother, the one who's tragically died on June 13th in a plane crash.
And we're so, so sorry.
Yeah,
about that.
Thank you.
I know you're heartbroken.
I am. He and my sister Peggy, the next oldest, were probably just like twins. They were 15 months apart, and I was 3 years younger than Richard. And then there were the three older ones, where the two sisters were very close, and they were only something like 13 months apart. They were very close. So my brother David and I are the bookends of the family, and I would say we both grew up, in a sense, outside the family, or at least outside the clan that developed in the middle. But this all changed in the last 5 or 10 years as all of us realized that it was just so important for us to work through those old patterns and come to a place of closeness with each other. And I'm so incredibly grateful that my brother Richard and I seem to have resolved all of our differences, really. I mean, we just were complete with one another and very comfortable, emailed each other all the time in the last year especially.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Yeah.
Well, Eileen, you mentioned that your house was very busy with people going in and out and the secretaries and the cooks and everything else. And your parents must have been so busy. Did you feel like you didn't have a lot of alone time with your parents? Did you feel like they had time for you?
Well, I know that they absolutely did their best, and in some ways I got probably more of their time than the others. Because I was naturally younger than my siblings and wasn't included, which has been that sense of loneliness, as it is for any one of us, we all have wounds from childhood, and if we're lucky or we're conscious enough, we can turn those wounds into our purpose and to find meaning in life. So my sense of loneliness turned me into a real connector, and I love connecting with people. I love helping connect people and ideas in new organizations, as I've done and describe in my book. But I would say that because I was younger, my other siblings went away to school, and I actually had 2 years alone at home with my parents that only my brother David would have had at the very beginning. So I did have quite a lot of time with them.
And Eileen, you dedicated your book to your grandmother as well as your husband, Paul.
Yes.
Can you tell us about your grandma?
Well, here's the irony, is that I actually never met her, but she has been a kind of spirit figure in my life. She came to me in a dream the night that my first and oldest uncle died in 1976, I think it was. I was on a camping trip in Idaho, and I had a dream that she came to me to visit me in the home that my parents had in real life given me in Maine, which had been the caretaker's cottage for my grandparents when they were alive. And in the dream, she was walking around. This is Abby Aldrich Rockefeller. She was walking around the house with me and looking at some of the paintings or prints that she had, in fact, put in that house in real life herself. And
wow.
They're still there. And she was sort of taking my arm in a very loving way and saying, "Now, dear, I just want you to know this is your home now. And if you want to change, you can change all or any of these pictures and have it be exactly as you want." And it felt like it was such an important symbol, and that the fact that she came in that dream for the very first time the night that my uncle was dying, I don't honestly know why there was that coincidence. And I knew something had happened in the family intuitively, but I didn't learn for 5 days because we didn't have cell phones in those days. And they just couldn't find me in time for the service.
Oh, gosh.
So I've always equated those two things, that as my Uncle John left this world, somehow his mother, my grandmother, came to me in spirit form. And she's felt like a protective guardian ever since.
Hmm. Well, so much of your book really resonates, and I think just maybe what you were saying also about to you the importance of family.
Yeah.
And while, you know, you may have all the wealth in the world or you may have a whole boatload of things, but there's really nothing like family and friendships and nature and enjoying the world that we live in.
Right. That's absolutely so true. And I think that one of the greatest challenges in our country today is how do working women balance their jobs that they need for the support of partial or all of the support of the family with being a parent and really taking the time to listen to their children, to be with their children in whatever way they can. And I want to say for the audience that the research that I've seen from the National Merit Society some years ago looked at 100 different characteristics of what caused a person to do so well in such a well-rounded way that they were chosen for National Merit Scholarship. And the only factor that they found in common out of 100 different variables was that the people had eaten dinner with their family.
Right. Wow. Now, to turn off the TV,
yes,
and sit around and talk.
Turn off the TV, put away the phones, put away the computer games, and just be together. Ask how your day went. And even if it's met with silence, just the parents have the obligation to be curious about their children, to listen to their children. And if we don't, we're going to see more and more shootings as our children age, because there's a crying need to be heard and to be seen.
Our guest is Eileen Rockefeller, philanthropist and member of that famous American family. I'm Barbara Klein, and my co-host is Kathy Bernard. You can listen to the show anytime on the iHeartRadio app or at iHeartRadio.com. Now back to our conversation with Eileen Rockefeller about her new memoir, Being a Rockefeller, Becoming Myself. Eileen, let's just sort of go back a little bit to your mother, who sounds like a real hoot. She seemed famous for her pranks. And one story that we really, really enjoyed in your book was when you were out sailing and your mom decided that you would all have lamb chops for dinner. So can you tell us what happened?
Yeah, that is
lamb chops will never be the same to me now.
Oh, my gosh. Well, I'm so glad to know that. They've never been the same to me since that story. Well, we were at an island in Maine, and so we had put our anchor down, and my dad was wanting to, I don't know whether he was taking a rest or what he was doing, but the rest of us all rowed ashore because we wanted to see the sheep. There were many sheep grazing on the island, and my mother just got it into her head when she got there. I guess it was just the craziest idea she could think of. She said, "Let's capture the ram." And so the ram was coming right up to us. That was not a problem. He was going to defend all of his sheep. Before he knew it, my mother had flung off her blue jean jacket and put it over his head. He had no idea what was happening, and we lifted him into the rowboat.
Oh my gosh.
And so he was fairly still for a while because he was quite stunned and what was happening, and we rowed him out to the boat. Whereupon my mother called to my father, "David, we have something for you because we're going to have lamb chops for dinner." And he comes to the side of the boat and says, "Darling, this is just shocking beyond belief." And at this point, the ram begins to realize that it's had quite enough time in the boat. Whereupon we realize that we will all be in the freezing Maine water very soon if we don't row him right back. So we did. We rowed him back, and then we made some kind of a makeshift flag with some skull and crossbones that we hoisted up the mast just in case somebody had been watching us from another island.
So that ram went on to live a long, healthy life, right?
It did. And
good.
We did happen to have lamb chops in the icebox on board, which we cooked that night.
Oh, my gosh.
So we had so many laughs. It was a lot of fun.
Eileen, you eventually met and fell in love with a wonderful man named Paul Growald, your husband.
Well, it's quite unique. I don't know many other men who have such a passion for pollinators as my husband, Paul. He started the Pollinator Partnership that is actually responsible for President Obama's having signed that referendum the other day to protect the land that pollinator and flowers that pollinators live off of.
Wow.
I'm so proud of him.
Oh, that's so great. Well, has your relationship with Paul really helped ground you, you know, and did it help you really find yourself? What was it that you really felt you needed to find your voice?
Well, I think, as with each of us, the process of finding our mate is like a process of coming home, that we know we've found the right person when we can be completely ourselves with that person. And we're lucky if they have the same values and the same drive to continue to know themselves so that the relationship can continue to grow. And I think that's been the most wonderful thing about Paul's and my relationship, our marriage of almost 33 years. It's not all been easy, as I describe in my book, but we have always been willing to work on the pieces of ourselves that we tend to want to project onto the other, and use the conflict as an opportunity for personal growth and growth in the relationship. And I think that's something that we've modeled to both of our sons.
Well, Eileen Rockefeller, author of Being a Rockefeller, Becoming Myself, thanks so much for giving us a glimpse of what it's like to be part of one of the most famous families in America. It's been a pleasure.
Oh, thank you very much, Barbara and Kathy. It's been a pleasure to talk with you.
In 2008, it was estimated that $11 billion were spent on self-improvement books, CDs, seminars, and coaching, according to Market Data Enterprises, and that number continues to rise. So just who are these so-called inspirational prophets doling out all this great advice we're so eager to pay for?
Far too often, some turn out to be charlatans who fall tragically and sometimes comically short of the values they champion. In Good Advice from Bad People, Selected Wisdom from Murderers, Stock Swindlers, and Lance Armstrong, writer Zach Bissonette shares jaw-dropping advice from so-called prophets, illustrating the reality behind the expression, "Do as I say, not as I do." Zach joins us on the phone from New York. Welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
Zach, let's talk about some of these hypocrites who dole out advice and don't exactly heed it themselves. First, there was the disgraced former Congressman Jesse Jackson Jr., who wrote a book with his dad, the Reverend Jesse Jackson Sr., called It's About the Money, How You Can Get Out of Debt, Build Wealth, and Achieve Your Financial Dreams. And then here's a quote from the book. Living above your means is financial sin. And it really kind of turns out that he really was a financial sinner, right?
Yeah, he is currently incarcerated in federal prison for campaign finance violations. The gist of what he pleaded guilty to doing was using money that he had raised for a political campaign, essentially stealing it from the campaign and using it to buy rare Michael Jackson memorabilia and fur coats and sort of luxury goods and that kind of thing.
Wow. So I take it his book is not on the bestseller list anymore,
It is out of print, mercifully.
Yeah, I would imagine. Okay, now this next one I got a big kick out of. The first-class offender, Victoria Osteen, wife of megachurch pastor Joel Osteen, and she's the author of the bestseller Love Your Life, Living Happy, Healthy, and Whole. And in the book, she writes, and I quote, "We need to learn to have realistic expectations and let people off the hook. By giving people room to be human, we can avoid a lot of heartache," end quote. But Zach, didn't she also have a problem following her own advice, especially on an airplane?
Yeah, the gist of what happened was she was on a flight with her husband and family, I believe to Vail, Colorado, for a ski vacation, and she was sitting in first class and was upset about some sort of liquid that had been spilled on her armrest, and became incredibly angry with the flight attendants, and was shouting, according to people who were there, "This is ridiculous. I'm a first-class passenger." There were some allegations that she pushed a flight attendant. She denied that. But in any case, she was escorted off the plane with her family and paid a FAA fine of $1,000 for interfering with the flight crew. And certainly did not let the flight attendant off the hook. Not that I really, look, if that's the worst thing she's ever done, she's lived a pretty good life. But I think it's just, that when, these self-help experts can be so sanctimonious and, that when you sort of put yourself out there as someone is this sort of purveyor of wisdom, I think you often set yourself up for a fall.
Oh, yeah. And do you have any idea if her popularity has fallen since this incident, or has it affected it at all?
I don't think she's done another book like that one. She's really, she's mainly, Joel Osteen is the megachurch pastor, and she kind of, rides coattails in terms of celebrity, and, I think is a co-pastor of the church and, involved in the church, but I don't think that she has as high of a profile at the moment.
Yeah, well, maybe she'll write about birds or something next time.
Yeah, exactly. Something totally different. Something that does not rely on your own wonderful reputation.
Well, in the financial arena, there is a very long list of people not practicing what they preach. But one group that really kind of disappointed us was the ladies from the Investment Club in Beardstown, Illinois. And they wrote their best-selling The Beardstown Ladies Common Sense Investment Guide, How We Beat the Stock Market and How You Can Too. I always love the titles of those books.
Yeah.
They seem to be so nice and upstanding. And they even, put their favorite chicken recipes, in the book. But what happened there?
It was all a little too darling for my taste, to tell you the truth. It was a little too cloy and sort of self-consciously cute. But the gist is that kind of in the 90s, there was this big, kind of led by Peter Lynch, this idea, that you can do it and you can invest in the stock market yourself and beat the market. And there was this investment club of sort of older ladies from Beardstown, Illinois, who were kind of the poster children for that. And, they'd had this investment club for years, and they had, according to the returns that they wrote about, been beating the S&P 500 and most professional money managers by quite a large amount. And then it turned out a few years into their celebrity, where they'd been on virtually every talk show and were very famous, and then it turned out that they had miscalculated their investment returns and actually were lagging the market, not beating it. I should say that there was never any allegation, and I certainly don't, that they had intentionally inflated their figures. I take them at their word that it was unintentional. But I think, when you really look at all the data on this, most people should buy mutual funds. Most mm-hmm. people will not beat the market buying stocks on their own. And so, in a weird way, they actually kind of ended up being the best example of the good advice, which is the opposite of what they were saying, because they were saying go and buy individual stocks on your own, which is a terrible idea for most people. And as it turned out, they would have been better buying mutual funds, and so would most people.
Well, it's really funny because I'm an investment club, and we started right around the same time as the Beardstown Ladies, mm-hmm. and we use them as an example. And you know what? We haven't made any money in 15 years. So.
Yeah, and I will say that the good argument for investment clubs, not to get off on a tangent, but I don't want to seem like I'm trashing them, is that, with small amounts of money, it can be a social thing and a way to kind of learn about the market and that kind of thing.
Oh,
and
sure.
Learn about business. And it's not uninteresting or harmful, but I still think that for, especially in terms of retirement, most people are better with mutual funds.
Sure. Well, I always love it when Barbara's getting ready for investment club meeting because she has to go buy wine and cheese.
That's the important stuff.
Yeah, that's always a good sign.
These are priorities.
They're very serious.
Actually, I think that's what they were doing at Lehman Brothers.
Yeah, really. Well, we make better investment decisions when we're drinking a little wine,
Of course.
Well, we're talking with Zach Bissonnette, author of Good Advice from Bad People, Selected Wisdom from Murderers, Stock Swindlers, and Lance Armstrong, about some inspirational prophets who turn out to be quite the opposite. Okay, so Donald Trump also made your list, which is not terribly surprising.
No.
But let me read this absolute head shaker of a quote from his book, Trump Surviving at the Top, and have you respond. Okay, so and I quote, "You have to be confident as you face the world each day, but you can't be too cocky. Anyone who thinks he's going to win them all is going to wind up being a big loser," end quote. I mean, there is so much irony in those words.
Right. I mean, I think that if you were to sort of do a man on the street poll and just ask random people, who's the cockiest man in America? I think probably 70% of sort of randomly selected strangers would say Donald Trump. So to have him giving advice on avoiding sort of cockiness is interesting. But what I especially like about that is that was in his book Surviving at the Top, which came out in 1991 or 1992, I believe, right as his real estate empire was collapsing under the weight of excessive debt born of his own grandiosity. And the timing of the book did not sell well because it was so ironically timed. There was a Los Angeles Times reviewer who wrote at the time, you know, that for Donald Trump to be coming out with a book called Surviving at the Top, you know, it's like Marie Antoinette writing a book called Keeping My Head.
Well, Zach, finally, there are so many major hypocrites in your book, but if you just had to pick one, your very favorite, and I know it's really hard, who would be in the top of the list?
I think it's Donald Trump's a pretty good choice, but I think my personal favorite is Richard Fuld, who was the CEO of Lehman Brothers, who went back to his alma mater, Colorado State, in 2006, 2.5 years before the collapse of Lehman Brothers, which was the largest bankruptcy in U.S. history that he led the company into. And in his commencement speech there, he said, and I quote, "When you know what you are talking about, others will follow you because it's safe to follow you." And people did, and they lost everything.
Do as I say, not as I do.
Exactly.
Well, Zach Bissonnet, author of Good Advice from Bad People, somehow I feel like I need a shower after this convo.
Yeah, you know, I got an email from someone saying, you know, they'd read it expecting it to be funny, but it was mostly just depressing. And I was like, well, that's good, too.
Well, thanks so much for joining the Two Boomer Babes.
Anytime. Thanks so much.
Up next, 90 years young and going strong. Stay with us. Support comes from Accent on Travel Rehoboth Beach with a Viking Rhine River cruise with us, the Two Boomer Babes. For questions and reservations, 302-703-6154.
Come on, smile.
Oh, honey, he's still not smiling.
Maybe he's not a smiler.
Yeah, maybe he's just not a happy baby.
Maybe he's just being a boy.
Or maybe he's teething.
Maybe it's just a phase.
Maybe he has autism, and we can definitely do something to help.
Maybe is all you need to find out more about autism. No Big Joyful Smiles by 6 months is one early sign. Learn the others at autismspeaks.org/signs. Brought to you by Autism Speaks and the Ad Council.
There are some very cool 90-year-olds out there doing the most amazing things. Take former President George Bush, for example, who recently went skydiving just for the heck of it. Then there's my sister-in-law's mom, Marion, who's actually 99. She plays bridge every single night, get this, online with her daughter and a host of strangers. And she's virtually unbeatable.
Our next guest joins the rank and file of amazing 90-year-olds. Mary Hartsock was recently awarded the Caregiver of the Year Award. At 90, she's a paid professional who cares daily for others who are often younger and sometimes a whole lot younger than she is. This inspiring senior joins us from Frederick, Maryland. Welcome, Mary.
Well, thank you.
Well, you were chosen from a field of 15,000 other caregivers. I mean, how did it feel to be recognized as Caregiver of the Year? That was quite an honor.
Yes, it was. At first run, had won the eastern section of the United States. Then they called for me to come out to Omaha, Nebraska. And when I went out there, found out that I had won the national.
Oh, wow. Well, congratulations to you. Now, Mary, when did you begin your caregiving job? How old were you?
79.
Oh, my goodness. When most people are retired, you're just getting going, right?
Right.
And how many hours a week did you originally work when you started working at 79?
Well, I guess I can remember a couple week times that I worked 46 hours.
Wow. That's a lot.
And when patients are ill, sometimes it takes up a lot of time.
Well, Mary, you obviously are a very active person, but, you know, caregiving, as we know, can be very physically draining. How do you do it? You must be in fabulous shape.
Well, I have diabetes. That's the only thing I have, but it's under control. I feel well, so I like to help other people.
Do you work out, Mary, to keep in shape? Or I bet just your job gives you enough exercise probably to keep in shape.
No, I do some exercises, but I do them at home.
Oh, wow.
And I don't watch television.
So what kind of exercises do you do?
I do a lot of walking. And you can stand and swing your feet and legs and just keep on the move. Too many people sit down and watch TV. Really?
And you don't watch any TV, huh?
I watch the news, and I watch NASCAR. I'm crazy about that.
But other than that, forget those nighttime shows, like I'm addicted to, right?
Soap operas, I think they call them. I don't watch them at all.
Mary, did you have to pass a physical fitness test with your employer?
Yes, I had a test before I could ever go to work.
Because we understand you had to lift 30 pounds in order to work as a caregiver?
I had to lift pounds, yes.
Wow, that's a lot of pounds.
I still lift 40 sometimes.
Good for you. And Mary, you've often been older than some of your clients.
Oh, yes. Most all the time I'm older than my clients. The ones that I have now is 89.
Well, did anyone ever question your age and ability to care for their loved one?
No, not really. No, families have all been so polite and nice to me and the client themselves. I tell people when I go to work with a client for the first day, I don't do much work because I'm spending the day with that client. I got to know every little if and then that they like and what they want me to do. And as I told people before, I want to know if they drink cream in their coffee and if they have that early morning or do they take a bath. And oh, there's just a number of things you have to find out.
Well, Mary, you sound like one amazing caregiver. Have you always worked?
Oh, yes.
Were you in the caregiving business previously or?
No, I was in hotel business for a while. I worked at the Francis Scott Key Hotel for 28 years. I worked as assistant manager for 3 years.
Well, Mary, did you have any experience in your own family that made you want to be a professional caregiver? Where did that drive come from?
Well, I lost my father and my brother to Alzheimer's. So I got through wanting to know a little bit more about Alzheimer's. And, of course, that led me into a health situation. And then I saw where Right at Home had an offer. I went to see him, and that's when I was 79, and I've been with him ever since.
Well, you are clearly very successful at what you do. How would you counsel those caregivers who are not professionals, but rather caring for a loved one in need? Like, what do you have a best piece of advice for this, you know, very stressful job?
Well, we just got to learn to know what their person needs and wants and what their illness is. There's an awful lot of things go into caregiving.
And it sounds like you make friends with your clients.
Oh, yes. I think my clients all liked me when I got through, and the families, you got to please more than just one. Because usually when a caregiver goes out, the family has called you to take care of their mother or their father or whoever it might be, and you got to come up with their standards also.
Mary, at 90 years of age, is retirement even on your radar screen?
Well, it is, but I don't like to be by myself and not do anything. I live by myself. I've been married twice. Both husbands died. So I've been by myself for 18 years. And I get very tired and lonely if I just stay home and don't do nothing. And I thought, well, as long as I was well enough, I'd just get out and do some work.
So, Mary, what's your secret? Tell me and Kathy to this long and very healthy and sounds like very happy life. What should we be doing?
You want to exercise. Don't sit down and watch that TV by hours. It's all right to turn one show on and look at it, but then turn it off and do something. Get going. Move. Walk. Like I say, I exercise my legs and my arms, and I do that all at home. You can do it right in your own home.
And Mary, your mind is so sharp. How do you keep it going? Do you do brain puzzles, or do you do...
Yes, I do some puzzles at nighttime if I'm not working or anything. I do some puzzles, yes.
And it sounds like you also have a lot of connections with people, you know, especially through clients. Right.
I get out and go with a lot of people. And I go attend things, and I belong to my church organization and two or three different ladies' auxiliary clubs. I don't have any relative in service, but the AMVETS here in Frederick, Maryland goes all out for all the veterans. And we pack boxes all summer long to send to them at Christmas time. and I worked several hours on that during the course of the summer.
Well, Mary Hartsock, 90-year-old Caregiver of the Year Award recipient, you are truly inspiring. Thanks so much for sharing your story with the two Boomer Babes.
Thank you.
Susan Patton created a media frenzy when a letter she wrote to her alumni college newspaper, the Daily Princetonian, went viral. In the letter, she encouraged young women to invest at least as much time, effort, and energy in finding a suitable husband as they do in their studies and future careers.
As you might imagine, her words were met with controversy, with some opining that Ms. Patton belongs back in the 1950s, while others cheered her for telling it like it really is. Either way, she has surely sparked some dialogue. Susan turned her letter into a book called Marry Smart, Advice for Finding the One. Welcome, Susan.
What a pleasure to be with you.
Great to have you with us. Well, Susan, I've got to ask you from the get-go.
Yeah.
Did you follow the advice you're offering other women when you were searching for the one?
No, I did not. Shame on me. I did not, because nobody told me. Nobody told me that if I missed the opportunity that I had when I was a student at Princeton in the mid-70s to find a wonderful man who was like-minded, age-appropriate, single, as smart as I was, nobody told me that. In the mid-70s, to say that you want to be married and have children was the epitome of uncool. It was just what we were not supposed to be saying. We were the women who were the daughters of the feminist revolution. We were supposed to set our sights on something loftier than the traditional roles of wife and mother. So even though I knew I wanted marriage and motherhood, every time I said it, my female classmates looked at me like I was some kind of heretic. I was talked away from finding the love of my life as a student. So instead, I spent the next 7-8 years dating men in New York that were nowhere nearly as good as the men I went to school with. Ultimately, I married Mr. Goodenough because I knew I was running out of time to have children. And that's what I really wanted. More than anything, the very top of my list of things to do was have children. So here I am in New York. I'm like 30 years old already, not getting any younger, very well aware of the biological realities of women in their 30s. I was dating a man who, again, not anywhere nearly as good as the men I knew when I was at Princeton. And it was just clear to me that it's time to settle smart, because if I end this relationship with Mr. Goodenough, there may not be Mr. Better waiting in the wings.
But Susan, let me be the devil's advocate there.
Go right ahead.
Don't you always think sometimes that the grass is greener, or we perceive it to be greener on the other side? I mean, maybe you found Mr. Goodenough, but maybe at Princeton, who knows what you would have found?
No, that's absolutely true. But I'm very cognizant of the fact that I married when I did because I was feeling like I was running out of time. And let me just say, I did have two sons, the exact sons I always dreamed of. They both went to Princeton. They're brilliant. They're wonderful young men. They're exactly the children I always dreamed of. My marriage ended in divorce. So I'm telling young women, I've lived through it. I've learned from it. Trust me when I tell you, you'll never have a greater concentration of men to choose from than you do when you're a college student. So use your opportunity on campus to do many things. Of course, get a wonderful education, meet your best friends, explore all the areas that are of interest to you, play in the marching band, write for the school paper. And while you're doing all of that, look around at the young men who are on your college campus, because you'll never again have this concentration of extraordinary men to choose from in an environment that is organic to meeting them.
Okay, so Susan, did your sons get snatched up while at Princeton?
Well, it just so happens my older son is married to a classmate of his.
Uh-huh.
My younger son is graduating in 3 weeks and has not settled down yet. But, you know, the advice is not the same for men that it is for women.
But why is that? Why is it different for men and women?
After all, they have a great gene pool of smart women to go
without
after.
Without a doubt. But here's the difference. Because men have an unlimited time frame within which they can marry and have children, there is no imperative on them to hurry up and find the right girl. And in fact, I have classmates, men who are my age, who are first-time parents now of 3-year-olds and 4-year-olds, because some of them married in their 50s, and it doesn't hurt them. They're still able to have the families that they always dreamed of, but that's not an option for women, because women have a biological imperative if they want children, and obviously my advice is not for all women, but for women who know that they want to have children, have a family. They cannot play this the way men do. They cannot wait until their mid-30s to think about getting married and having children for so many reasons, not the least of which is they're going to be competing for these 35-year-old men with women who are 10 years younger than them. Well, a 35-year-old woman cannot compete with a 25-year-old woman for many reasons, not the least of which is that a 25-year-old woman has 10 more years of fertility on her.
Our guest is Susan Patton, a.k.a. the Princeton Mom and author of Mary Smart. We're talking to her about her rather unconventional advice for finding the one. So, Susan, let me ask you, when I was reading your book, I thought, okay, well, I didn't go to Princeton. I went to a state school. So what happens to us poor schlubs who go to a state school and we don't have this incredible gene pool to choose from? I mean, is it hopeless?
It's certainly not hopeless, and there's nothing schlubby about going to a state
there
school.
There isn't, actually.
There absolutely is not, but I'm just saying that when you're in college, it's the best time to think about finding a life partner. I think that if you are able to find somebody with whom you went to college, you have a life partner to share those critical foundation years of your 20s that you move towards building career, building family. The major components in your life come together in your 20s. Wouldn't it be wonderful to have a life partner at the beginning of that, that you grow together with, that you build together with?
Susan, let me ask you about some of your more unconventional quotes from your book.
I don't think anything about it is unconventional. Well, in fact, I think it's old-fashioned advice, which means it's stood the test of time.
Well, controversial, let me put it
indeed.
That way. Okay.
Absolutely.
So you write that when a girl enters college, and I quote here, she will never again be as young, as beautiful, as attractive to men, or as fertile. Encourage her to make the best use of this time. But you make it sound, and I have two girls, and so does Kathy. I mean, we're kind of sensitive to this, that college girls are sort of a commodity. They're ripe for the picking, and that they should be hooking a husband. I mean, that should be their main goal before they grow too old and ugly. I mean, is that really a good message to send to our daughters?
Well, I'm certainly not saying that they're growing old and ugly, because I don't think they are growing old and ugly. But I do think that it's an incontrovertible fact that women during their college years are at their most beautiful. They are at their most desirable. They are the most fertile.
But that's so superficial.
No, it's not really superficial. But if you think about it, where are these women, once they're no longer in a school environment, where do you think they're going to meet appropriate men?
In the workplace.
No. No.
In their apartment buildings. It's sports.
They're smart.
Volunteering. They've landed great jobs.
Let me tell you why that's not a good idea. And I don't know if you read a little bit more about my background, but I'm a human resources professional. I have been for 20 years. This is what I do. I am an HR babe. I tell women all the time, do not even think about dating anybody you work with.
I married my husband, and I met him at work. And we've been married for 30 years.
I understand that, and you were very lucky. But do you know how many women get involved with men that they work with? The relationship doesn't work out. It becomes incredibly awkward, not just for them, but for everybody. Somebody is usually forced to leave, and it's usually going to be the woman. I'm telling women, don't mix business and pleasure. Your work persona is important. Don't get it clouded with your being sort of the office date. You know, you're the girl who's been with this one and that one and the other one. It's not good for a woman's reputation to be romantically involved with somebody on the job. I always tell women, because I'm an executive coach as well as an HR consultant, I'm telling women, do not get involved with anyone you work with. You put your professional persona at risk by doing so. Now, I certainly know that there are people who have met their spouse at work, but I'm just telling young women that's not a smart strategy, even though it sometimes works.
Perhaps they can meet someone in the work environment, though, being in an association, being a member of an organization
Maybe.
In the same
Maybe.
Field, you know, those things. Susan,
yeah.
Let me just ask you about this other controversial piece of advice
sure.
that you offer.
Sure.
And I'm quoting you on this. If you struggled with obesity through most of your teen years, then maybe surgical intervention is a good idea for you.
Yep.
If you're going to go the route of cosmetic surgery, do it early enough to feel comfortable in your new body before going away to school.
Exactly.
Now, as a mother, to two beautiful girls, and Barbara as well, Do you really think that advising, you know, overweight but not necessarily unhealthy teens to get mm-hmm. weight loss surgery to mm-hmm. kind of trim yep. down before going to college is sound advice?
Let me tell you why this is critically important. And, you know, before everybody is all outraged over, oh, you know, it's so superficial, blah, blah, blah. Did all of your girls wear braces?
No. Nope. My kids have gorgeous natural teeth.
One of mine
never
did.
All right, you're lucky. You know that 80% of American teenagers wear braces, right? Why do we do that? It's for aesthetic reasons. So I'm saying that women, and I've known women my whole life, some have been struggling with obesity for 40 years and finally got weight loss surgery in their 50s. Well, by the time they're in their 50s, if they've been struggling with obesity for 30 or 40 years, the psychological damage that it's done to them has already set in. In some cases, they've never found husbands. If you go the route of this kind of surgery in your 50s, your body doesn't respond. It doesn't come back, bounce back the way it will when you're in your teen years. And I'm saying, and you know, I'm sure both of you know, have friends who have daughters who are struggling so with obesity. They've been struggling for 10 years. And all the yelling that we're going to do to our young women about put down the cake and stop eating ice cream and don't drink that, that doesn't help. That only hurts. If your daughter has been struggling with obesity for 10 years, I'm saying help her do for herself what clearly she has not been able to accomplish. I'm saying help your daughter feel good about who she is so she could enter her university years, which I'm saying are her prime dating years, feeling good about herself. I'm not saying get your daughter weight loss surgery so that she could attract a man. I'm saying get your daughter weight loss surgery so she could enter her college years feeling good about herself and knowing that every time she walks into a classroom or a party or anywhere, people aren't going to turn and look at her and say, oh, look at that fat girl, because you know that's what she's been dealing with.
Well, we'll just have to agree to disagree on this one and a few other ones.
That's perfectly fine.
Well, Susan Patton, author of Mary Smart, this has been a most interesting conversation, and thanks so much for joining the Two Boomer Babes. We appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Our next guest has had one heck of a life ride, and it's not nearly over. This real-life Cinderella began as a normal middle-class Jersey girl who became a globe-trotting businesswoman, philanthropist, and celebrity.
Lauren Pizza, author of Meant to Be, joins us to shoot the breeze as she shares her unique perspective on life, death, families, motherhood, and more. Welcome, Lauren.
Thank you very much for having me.
It's our pleasure. And listen, you sure have had a lot of crazy experiences in your life. I mean, everything from near death to finding your Prince Charming. So when you were just 13 years old, you had a very, very scary brush with death. What happened?
My parents signed me up for sailing lessons for 2 weeks, and we should have never been out in the water that day. It was very rough. And I was on those little sailfishes. And so when I went around a buoy with my partner, it capsized, and I flipped backwards. And at that particular time, I was disorientated, and I didn't know which way was up or down, and I swam in the wrong direction.
Oh.
So all my energy went towards the wrong direction, and I hit the bottom. So I hit the mud, and I thought, oh, my God. So now I had to turn around, and even worse, now I'm caught underneath the boat. So at that particular time, I knew that I had no more energy left, and my whole body just went limp, and I was embraced in this amazing light, and I felt so calm, and my brain was thinking, oh, my God, like, I'm going to miss my mom and my dad. I'm the youngest of five. I feel bad for my brothers and my sisters, but this feels really good right now. And I was, it's still to this day, I've never felt that euphoria. And then probably, I would say, minutes later, someone got me from underneath the boat and brought me onto the little motorboat.
Well, did this experience make you a believer in afterlife?
Absolutely. I don't. There's not a doubt in my mind. There's not at all. I mean, I have to tell you, that feeling that I had, I didn't want to come back to Earth. It's weird. It's just, and maybe everybody could say, well, your drowning experience, your brain shuts off. Yeah, you could give some scientific thing, but all I could tell you is I just know my experience.
Did you tell anybody about this experience?
I told my parents. I have it in my diary. And my parents, again, I'm the youngest of five. They shushed it off, and they said, you're going to sailing tomorrow. It's paid for. And the next day, this happened July 29th, 1983. And I wrote about it. I told my parents, and I was out to sailing the next day. Like, nobody took it. You know, they figured I came home from sailing and everything was fine. I mean, it was so many years ago, they didn't worry. I mean, I don't know. I mean, it's still bizarre to me that the person who, maybe he just felt as though he's liable. It's weird. But.
Well, another out-of-body experience that you write about is meeting your husband, Joe, who
yeah.
you call your Prince Charming, and you say that this was your Cinderella moment. So what happened?
Well, it's interesting. From the place where I drowned, I could walk to the ocean. That's how close these two encounters happened. I was down at the Jersey Shore, and I prayed on the beach, and I said, God, I just want to meet someone who loves me as much as I love them. And within about 4 minutes, I walked off the beach, and I heard this roaring car, this sports car, and this guy got out. He looked like David Lee Roth with hair really long, with chains, and there was my husband.
You didn't think you were hallucinating?
I thought I was hallucinating. I might have been hungover from the night before, but there he was. And I said, the power of prayer is huge, and they listened, and here we are 20 years later.
Well, I have a single daughter in New Jersey, and I'm going to go tell her to stand right in that spot and do the same thing.
I'm a big believer that you ask. And a lot of times, those little angels, everybody's doing other jobs up there, and they networked, he and I, together. And it was under, you know, crazy odds, and it worked.
Well, Lauren, obviously spirituality plays a big role in your life. I mean, you just exude it. And your book is titled Meant to Be. How is it that these twists and turns in your life have been meant to be?
Well, I just think that, first of all, meant to be is universal in regards to everybody says it all the time. It's meant to be that I didn't drown and die at 13 years old. I mean, it was meant to be that I met my husband. It was meant to be that I sat next to this gentleman on the bus and, you know, I got an amazing job in the computer industry. Like, everything I feel, there's no such things as coincidences, and everything is meant to be. It's meant to be that I'm speaking to you right now.
Do you think that women are more intuitive than men?
I think that probably a majority of women are, but there is definitely a percentage of guys that are out there, but we definitely have the majority. I think my son is very intuitive. I think it's innate in him.
Well, Lauren Pisa, author of Meant to Be, The Lives and Loves of a Jersey Girl, we've always wanted to meet a real-life Cinderella, and there you are.
Yeah.
Thanks so much for shooting the breeze with the two Boomer Babes.
Okay, thank you.
Support comes from Accent on Travel, Rehoboth Beach, with a Viking Rhine River cruise with us, the two Boomer Babes. For questions and reservations, 302-703-6154.
And now it's time for us babes to give credit where credit is due.
Audio and technical guru Julio Gonzalez, who magically pulls it all together.
Webmaster wizard Gail Jane, who makes twoboomerbabes.com a fab place to visit.
Founding members of the Chicago chapter of the Two Boomer Babes Supper Club, Mike and Larry Israel, for your unfailing love and support.
Our husbands, daughters, family, and friends, even with smirks and eye rolls, who encourage us all the way.
And give us great material, often without knowing it.
Our moms and upstairs directors, Jane and Sally, who are cheering us on from their bridge game in the sky.
Our home away from home, Delmarva Public Radio. And to you, our listeners, for joining us each week and spurring us on.
Two Boomer Babes is a production of Two Boomer Babes Media in collaboration with Zimer Communications.
Women now make up 37% of the workforce, changing their role forever.
Harvard Medical School has now opened its doors to new female applicants.
The first woman is now in space.
The majority of last year's doctorate degrees were earned by women.
We've come so far, but our news is changing for the worse. More women die from heart disease and stroke than men, even though it can be prevented. Make a change at GoRedForWomen.org today. Brought to you by the Ad Council and the American Heart Association's Go Red for Women.